Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. A biospecimens working group for a national children's health program has a new co-chair. This group is part of the Environmental Influences on Child Health Outcomes, or ECHO. Amy Elliott, is a Sanford researcher and was appointed by her ECHO colleagues. She joins me now at the SDPB studios in the University of Sioux Falls. Amy Elliott, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with what ECHO is. Give us an overview.
Oh, sure. So ECHO, Environmental Influences on Child Health Outcomes, is a national study that has engaged researchers from across the country. 35 different grants were awarded to investigate a whole host of environmental influences. And so that can mean everything from prenatal influences, prenatal alcohol, smoking, nutrition, medical care, to exposures such as in the air quality, pesticides, and even psychosocial things like stress, maternal depression, low socioeconomic status, things like that. So it's very broad in how they define environment. And what we're looking at is how do those whole variety of environmental influences impact asthma, obesity, affect babies that were born prematurely, neurodevelopment, including things like autism and ADHD, as well as just general positive health.
Tell me about the scope of this as far as duration, and then let's get into how you're trying to collect the data.
Oh, yeah. So it starts with a kind of a two-year planning period where about 200 scientists get together multiple times a year to work on putting together a common protocol that'll happen across all of these different sites. And if you look at where all these sites are, there's quite a few on the coast, and then there's one dot in South Dakota, and that would be us. In fact, we're one of the only sites in the entire Midwest that's involved in this national effort.
How come?
Good question.
Yeah, because I want more dots in the middle.
I would like the same. Traditionally, when you look at where the high-powered research has occurred, it's been at your Ivy League institutions, your very big colleges and universities. And that has made it difficult for a lot of us in the Midwest to compete. For those types of funding. But what's been happening recently, in recent years, and that's through a lot of the initiative and investment that have been made by places like Sanford in improving our research infrastructure, is we're now competitive and we're playing with the big boys.
So we're a dot because you're a dot.
We're a dot.
You planted the flag and then the money comes to you.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
You have to build some infrastructure to be able to do that. And why we're competitive is in part because of where we're located and that we have the infrastructure to support this type of very sophisticated biomedical research in an area that typically hasn't been funded. And we've got the expertise, we've got the community partners, we've got it kind of all together.
We've got the population.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of interest in learning more about both rural populations, right. American Indian populations. We have some of the worst health disparities in the country right here in South Dakota between our American Indian populations and the Caucasian population. And so NIH has been very interested in that. But unless they have kind of, as you said, a place mm-hmm. to put the flag, it's difficult for research to happen in this area. But
okay.
That's changing.
I got you a little off track. So two years of sort of planning and looking at what the protocols are going to be, and then what? And where are we at in this stage?
So we are just finishing our first year of planning.
Okay.
The common protocol should be completed by this fall, and we're hoping to start it about midwinter in 2018. And then it'll run for 5 years is how much our current funding is. But the hope is that we'll be able to continue to grow upon that and follow kids even longer over time.
Right.
Hopefully it'll become like the next Framingham cardiovascular study, which looked at heart disease in Massachusetts and now has been going on for 40, 50 years.
What's the advantage of a long-term, especially when you're studying child development,
yeah.
and then say, what if we could follow these same people for 40 years? What do you learn that you can't learn with just following them for 5 or 10?
Exactly. So things we'll be doing is collecting information, again, on these whole variety of exposures that happen during pregnancy and early childhood, before a kid's 5 years old. And there's a lot of outcomes that don't happen until people get older. for example. And so when you think about a child, learning issues in school, right? Depression, psychosocial, even obesity, type 2 diabetes. And so then as people age, we don't know necessarily, unless you follow those kids long term, how those early exposures in both pregnancy and early childhood affect adult health, and or affect even teenage health.
Right.
And so it's only by following kids long term that we can get that answer.
So when we talk about biospecimens, I'm thinking microscopes and slides. And are you talking about sitting down and just asking people questions? What's the research look like?
You know, we do a little bit of all of that.
Okay.
And so there is, for the biospecimen group that I got appointed to help lead from NIH, that is collection of things like saliva, okay? Even things, hair, fingernails, all of that has information that is very, very valuable. On both from genetic point of view, but also on things that you've been exposed to in your environment. So, for example, through a hair sample, you could find out how much environmental smoking has went on around you because it essentially literally soaks into your hair. And so you can get all kinds of information from these biosample specimens,
okay,
which just sounds very fancy for stuff our bodies can tell us.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, buccal swabs, obviously blood, cord blood, placenta, and all of those things. And so what we're doing through this committee is how to collect information in as easy way possible for the participant.
Right.
Obviously, we don't want to put kids through a lot of blood draws or other things that could hurt or would turn them off, basically, of wanting to be involved. But how do we also answer the questions in the most important way and get all of these sites all across the country doing things the same way?
Mm.
We also ask a lot of questions, have kids do different tests so we can measure how well their attention is, their cognitive functioning, so, and all kinds of different things.
So where will you be gathering the research participants in the state?
So we will be using our offices here in Sioux Falls as well as in Rapid City.
Okay. Ages?
So the we'll be recruiting about 2,200 women while they're pregnant, and then also recruiting from participants that just completed a big study that we just did called the Safe Passage Study. Those people that were in that study will now be invited to come back and be part of ECHO, and they're anywhere between age 1 and 10 right now.
How the Safe Passage Study, are there results from that? Are we seeing some early indications of what it found out? Quick overview of what that was.
Sure.
Folks.
So that has been a study that we've been doing in this region for quite some time. And the purpose was to look at the role of prenatal exposures on stillbirth and sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS. And those major results are going to be rolling out here in the next couple months.
Interesting. And when you have a study like that or a study like the one that's coming up, what's the dropout rate or the, it probably has a technical term.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
From the individuals who say, I'm not coming back.
Yep.
And how do you keep people coming back to make the study tell you what you want to know?
That's something actually we talk about a lot. So it's called attrition
Thanks.
Technical term. And one of the things that I think is nice about doing research in this area is folks really are willing to participate in research because they want to help other folks and other people. And so if you look at our compliance rate, so how well people came in for all of their study visits, it was over 85% for the Safe Passage Study, which is just incredible because these are lots of appointments. And it's also when people are pregnant or in the first year of life. And so we have been able to, we've been working on recontacting people to see if they're interested in being involved. And it's over 95% people are agreeing. So we've got a really high rate of people that agree to participate in research as well as agree to continue that. I also think a big part of that is we have just great staff that get relationships with people. They care. They help with a whole variety of issues. And creates some nice relationships.
How does that compare to sites across the country on the coasts? Are they having high success with those compliance and attrition?
You know, I'll always brag us up.
And we're okay with that.
You know,
let's brag up South Dakota for a while.
Exactly. I'm sure they're doing fine as well. I mean, we're just kind of getting started on these things. But I do think that the bonds that we form, as well as just the sense of community that we have here in the Dakotas, really works in our favor in this type of study.
So tell me what you can tell from a little infant's fingernail. Like what, you know, you mentioned the environmental exposure that is evidence in all these different places. And then you mentioned placenta and all sorts of stuff. Like what, at that early stage, what can you actually discover they've been exposed to?
Yeah. Well, let me give you an example of something that just came out in the research just a couple weeks ago that would be something like we'd look at. And this was with teeth. So with teeth that a kid naturally loses, they're not pulled, they're not, it's as they naturally lose them, okay? They were able to take that tooth and through a chemical process were able to find kids that were at risk for autism, okay, and later ended up getting diagnosed with autism, that there was increased exposure to lead that kid had during the time period around delivery, both in pregnancy as well as in that first month of life, as well as had a lack of some essential nutrients, zinc and manganese in particular. And that's the first time some of those had ever been identified and related to risk for autism. So, and that was back way before the autism had been identified during that pregnancy and that early developmental stage. So you could see how information like that could then start to lead to testing of different interventions and potentially, you know, prevention or at least decreasing severity.
How does a baby get exposed to lead?
You know, there's all kinds of ways, and they have improved a lot with new EPA standards around paint and building materials. Right. But in a lot of our, especially our low socioeconomic status areas, kids can still get exposed to lead paint in the area.
But they're not licking lead when they're 2 months old.
No, they're not. So that's a good question.
Yeah.
You know, is it something that maybe the mom is ingesting? Or some exposure in the environment that somehow she's taking in, and that's how it's being passed. I don't really know the answer to that.
Yeah.
But it.
So then, people whose children have autism are stamping their feet and saying, "Well, find out.
Exactly.
How come we don't know these things yet? How come we don't know some of these things that if it's in the teeth, we could have known."
I can feel
the frustration
from
parents who say, well, get on the stick and figure it out.
I know.
What's your response to that? Is that a money issue? We need to pour more money into research?
You know, it's research takes an agonizingly long time. Money can speed up the process, but research is still dependent on having the good ideas, having the technology, and being able to put it all together to answer the questions. And resources always help, right? Mm-hmm. To be able to get that. But a lot of problems you can't just throw money at to find the answer to. You have to have the right minds working on it as well. And so as technology continues to develop, I think the type of answers we're going to get will be increasingly sophisticated and being able to deal with complex issues. And as a researcher, I need to make sure that anything that I find is translatable right to families, to clinicians, and that has that immediate impact. And that's maybe something research hasn't always been the best at doing.
Right.
And so then we get this incredible delay between a research finding and its implementation. And so how do we get better at disseminating research results so that it can get implemented faster?
Right.
And so I hear the frustration. I feel it myself too.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of things that we can do that can actually help.
How does this compare to research studies in other countries? Where does America stand as far as the way we do this kind of research?
Yeah. So in a lot of European countries, for example, these longitudinal studies looking at child development and then how it relates to different adult outcomes and things like that are somewhat easier to do because there's more open access both to education records as well as medical records. So, for example, in some countries like the Netherlands, an infant, when they're born, gets an ID number. And that number is the same as their education number, as their medical record number, and everything is linked together. And it's also available, publicly accessible, obviously in more of a de-identified format and things, but it's publicly accessible. And so researchers can actually track a kid over time. And it's easy for parents to give access to that information to a researcher. So there's a lot of infrastructure set up. In the United States, we can do that, but there's a lot more separate systems that you have to go through to, you know, for example, if you go to one health system, you'll get one medical record. You go to another one, you get another medical record number.
Right.
You don't really have an education number that's constant throughout elementary school, middle school, high school, college. You know, right. So those links, it just makes it a little more difficult. So there's been a lot of very successful longitudinal studies in Europe in particular. And the U.S., we've been trying to do this. And what the approach they're taking now with ECHO is to use, have scientists as well as research teams that have already established cohorts or groups of research participants. So people have already agreed to participate in these studies going forward rather than starting completely from scratch.
How important is it to include Native American and Indigenous populations in a study such as this?
Oh, it's critical. It's critical, especially, I think, for American Indian population that is actually less than 2% of the entire United States population. But here in South Dakota, it represents 10 to 11% of our population. And also, there's very unique health needs as well as health strengths that exist in the American Indian population, as well as in other somewhat disenfranchised populations.
You mentioned autism. How about asthma? That's something that we're seeing, environmental exposure?
Yes, especially environmental smoking.
Really? Mm-hmm. So my daughter has asthma. Nobody smoked. Just... am I going to learn something 10 years from now that she
I
was
sure
exposed
hope so.
to?
Well, and you know, these are things that, so for example, exposure to prenatal smoking or smoking after they've been born can increase your risk, but that doesn't mean everyone with asthma was exposed to smoking.
Sure.
So something that necessarily increases your risk doesn't mean you have to have had that
right
to get asthma.
How much exposure is too much for some of these, you know, some of these chronic illnesses that we're seeing in our kids today? Like how, here's the heart of my question. How yeah. freaked out do pregnant mothers have to be and fathers, you know?
Yeah.
We're causing a panic a little bit. So before we get into that.
You know, a little bit of that public health messaging, though, I'm always happy when it starts to become an open conversation.
Right.
And it's hard to answer exactly how many drinks or how many cigarettes would, because it interacts with what your genetics are, what your family history might be. And so what I always tell, because I get asked this question, I get stopped in the grocery store and asked this question, you know, okay, yeah. I drank before I knew I was pregnant. Is my kid going to be okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to that always is you know, changes you make from this point going forward are really what you can control now. And so I really can't answer the question of in the past, what right. those exposures will have done or not done. But a woman who's pregnant, maybe she wasn't intending to get pregnant or found out late in her pregnancy. Okay. And things happened beforehand. That's done. And so what a parent can do now, though, because I think just by asking that question shows a good maternal instinct. You know, they're like, okay, what can I do?
Right.
You can work on taking care of yourself from this point going forward the best you possibly can, and just think of all that you're giving your child in that time period. And so I think there's always a question of, well, what if I did, you know, this or this happened? What are the effects that it relates to? And it may have an effect on your child's development. We're constantly learning new things in the environment that can affect development and outcomes. And that's the beauty of science. You know, hopefully we do know more in 20 years than we know now.
Yeah.
But it's really, you know, at the point when people start asking those questions and what they do from that point going forward, as well as subsequent pregnancies, that, I mean, really can help improve health.
All right. Help us get there and come back and talk to us again. Our time is short, but thank you so much, Amy Elliott.